Sorry, my microphone was off. I'm sorry, Judy. I got it. Hope lunch went okay. All right, good. All right. Your next witness?
Your Honor, we call Mr. John C. Depp.
All right. If you could stand, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Good afternoon, Mr. Depp.
Good afternoon.
Can you please tell the jury why you're here today?
About 6 years ago, Ms. Heard made some quite heinous and disturbing, brought these disturbing criminal acts against me that were not based in any species of truth. It was a complete shock that it would. It just didn't need to go in that direction, as nothing of the kind had ever happened, though the relationship, there were arguments and things of that nature, but never did I myself reach the point of striking Ms. Heard in any way, nor have I ever struck any woman in my life. And so I, at the time, because the news of this, her accusations had sort of permeated the industry and then made its way through media and social media, became quite a global let's say quote unquote fact, if you will. And since I knew that there was no truth to it whatsoever, I felt it my responsibility to stand up not only for myself in that instance, but stand up for my children, who at the time were 14 and 16. And so they were in high school, and I thought it was diabolical that my children would have to go to school and have their friends or people in the school approach them with the infamous People magazine cover with Miss Heard with a dark bruise on her face. And then it just kept it kept multiplying. It just kept getting bigger and bigger. So it was my responsibility, I felt, to not only attempt to clear my name for the sake of, well, for many reasons, but I wanted to clear my children of this horrid thing that they were having to read about their father, that was, which was untrue. And also, after many years of being in this industry, at the time it was probably, I'd probably been in the industry 30 plus years, 35 years. Never had any problems, anything like that. And I had met many people over the years, many of the people, and had had the opportunity to talk to those people and to even give advice to these people. And I'm not, my goal is the truth. My goal is the truth, because it killed me that people that I had spoken with, that I had met with over the years, who maybe were in a not such a great position and they needed advice, and I gave them the best advice I could, all I could think of was that those people would think that I was a fraud and that I had lied to them. And so I had to wait for my opportunity to address the charges, which were criminal charges. And they just weren't true. So I felt the responsibility of clearing the record as the only way that I could get to the point where I could speak has really taken this full 6 years, and it's been 6 years of trying times. It's very strange when one day you're Cinderella, so to speak, and then in 0.6 seconds you're Quasimodo. And I didn't deserve that, nor did my children, nor did the people who have believed in me for all these years. I didn't want anybody, any of those people, to believe that I had done them wrong or lied to them or that I was a fraud. I pride myself on honesty. I pride myself on truth. Truth is the only thing I'm interested in. Other lies will get you nowhere, but lies build upon lies and build upon lies. It's too much to cover. I'm obsessed with the truth, and so today is the first opportunity that I've been able to speak about this case in full for the first time.
Mr. Depp, how do you feel about the intimate details of your life being aired in this process?
As a father, raising kids, you know, when they were very, very little, it was important to me, very important to me, to try to shield my children as much as possible from looking at their father or their mom, for that matter, as novelties. I didn't want my children to experience hordes of paparazzis. So I was always a very private person. So for me to come up here and stand before you, or sit before you all, and spill the truth, is quite exposing. And it's unfortunate that it's not only exposing for myself, it's exposing for my family, it's exposing for Miss Heard, it's exposing for, it never had to go in this direction. And so I can't say that I'm embarrassed, because I know that I'm doing the right thing.
Now, Mr. Depp, I'd like to turn a bit to your upbringing. We heard a bit from your sister, Christy, last week. But can you please tell the jury in your own words about your childhood upbringing?
I had a very interesting childhood, one that I thought was normal until a certain age. My mother, I was born in Kentucky. And then we moved around quite a lot when I was a kid. So you were always just, my mom had this, her feet were on fire and she had to move, you know. So we moved constantly. So you were always the new kid. And that wasn't ever particularly pleasant. Then we moved to Florida, South Florida, when I was about 7 or 8. And again, moved several times, but my mother was quite unpredictable. She was very unpredictable. She was a she had the ability to be as cruel as anyone can be, with all of us, that is to say, my sister Christy and my brother Danny and my sister Debbie, and also my father. So, essentially, she was, she could become quite violent. And she was quite violent, and she was quite cruel, and she, and though there was physical abuse, certainly, which could be in the form of an ashtray being flung at you, you know, it hits you in the head, or you'd get beat with a high heel shoe, or a telephone, or whatever's handy. So in our house, there was no, we were never exposed to any type of safety or security. The only thing that one could do, really, was to try to stay out of the line of fire. I started to be able to observe and I could see, I could start to see when she was about to head into a situation where she was going to get riled up and somebody was going to get it. Generally, it was me.
Mr. Depp, you mentioned that your mother could be cruel. How could she be cruel?
Well, the various categories, I suppose, are there's physical violence, of course. There's physical abuse, to which she was. That was a constant. That was just a constant, you know. We were all somewhat shell-shocked, you know. Even if she just walked past, you'd sort of shield yourself because you didn't know what was going to happen. Excuse me. And so there was the physical abuse, which was a constant. There was quite a lot of verbal abuse. There was quite a lot of name calling and bullying. You know, making fun of whatever defect you know one might have. You know, if my brother wore glasses, so of course he was four eyes, and he had his teeth were messed up in the front, so he was buck tooth as well. My sister Christy, which this is such a hideous psychological play. My father's parents were quite refined. My mother comes from Eastern Kentucky, which is where you grow up in shacks and hollers, you know, and. My mother despised my father's parents, and my grandmother's name was Violet, and every now and again you would hear my mother just scream across the house, "Come here, Violet, get in here, Violet," and Christy, my sister, knew very well that was a deep cut psychologically, emotionally, but we had to take it. I mean, you just had to take the pain. I was born with a very strange, it was a very rare thing in my eye, as the back of the lens is spherical. Normally is spherical, so in this eye it isn't normal. This eye I was born with a more conical lens, so my brain never learned to see out of my left eye, and they noticed when I was about three, four, that I had a lazy eye, a wandering eye, and she would call me cockeye, one eye, anything she could get to demean, humiliate. I even had to wear an eye patch on my good eye to strengthen my bad eye so that it would cease to wander. It was exercising the muscles of the eye, though the brain had never learned to see. So I still, my vision in my left eye is, I'm legally blind in my left eye. But the verbal abuse, the psychological abuse, was almost worse than the beatings because the beatings were just physical pain. And the physical pain, you learn to deal with. You learn to accept it. You learn to deal with it. But the psychological and emotional abuse, that's what kind of tore us up, I think.
What about your father? What was he like?
My father was a very kind man. In fact, my father's still alive. He's a very kind man. He's a very quiet man. In fact, he's very shy. Not a confrontational person in any way. And when Betty Sue, my mother, would go off on a tangent toward my father, and of course in front of the kids it was no matter to her. He amazingly remained very, very stoic. And never, as she was rationing him with horrible things, he stood there and just looked at her while she delivered the pain, and he swallowed it. He took it. There was never one moment. Never a moment when my father lost control and attacked my mother or hit my mother or even said a bad thing to my mother. The things that I witnessed were, there were a couple of times when it got too far, that I could see his eyes welling up as he was staring at her, saying nothing. And then the most that he would do is he would punch a wall. I once saw him punch a wall and shatter his hand because it wasn't drywall, it was proper concrete and steel wire and rebar and things of that nature, and but still never touched her, never argued with her. He remained a gentleman, and to me, as a 5-year-old boy, I kept wondering why does he take it? How does he take this, and why doesn't he leave her? But he didn't. He was able to maintain his calm and his composure. He was able to maintain his relationship with his children. He was a good man. He is a good man.
You mentioned that you saw your father punch a wall. How many times did you witness that?
I mean, out of, I couldn't count the amount of fights that they had, but I know that I've seen my father strike a wall. Two or three times tops. Once when he broke his hand. But yeah, three times at tops, you know.
Was your father ever abusive to you or any of your siblings?
No, my father was not an abusive man. At the same time, my father was also to some degree at the mercy of Betty Sue. Because if he argued with what she wanted done, that would just turn into another barrage of hatred towards him. So I can remember my father coming home from work, and maybe I'd gotten a bad report card, or maybe I'd gotten in trouble at school, or something like that. And my father would arrive home from work, and the first thing she would say was, "John, take him out there. He gets the belt. Give him the belt." And he wanted to know what it was about, so he'd take me out to the garage, and I'll never forget the this white, thick leather 1970s era, thick leather white belt that he would take off, and then he would commence to inflict the punishment on me. But interestingly, there was one time when my father, I kept telling him I didn't do this. It was another incident. I kept swearing to him that I did not do what Betty Sue, what my mom had said that I'd done. But he went through with the punishment anyway. And then, not long after, he found out that I had been telling the truth and that I hadn't done what my mom had said that I'd done. And he came to me and apologized to me for having gone through with the whipping, you know, the belt. And I have to say, my mom never did that. She couldn't. She knew what she knew. She was raised how she was raised. And I had no power to change what was inside of her, you know.
How did your parents' relationship ultimately come to an end, to your understanding?
When my father left, I didn't realize that he had left. He left her. I was 15. I had already left school, and I was a musician. I was playing in clubs and such. And he left for work one morning, just like every day, and was packing his car, and then he left. And then hours later, my mom, Betty Sue, came home from work. It was about 3:30 in the afternoon. And she walked in the door and stopped and just looked around like she felt something. And she just, I said, "What's wrong?" She said, "Your daddy's gone." I said, "Well, yeah, I seen him leave for work this morning." She said, no, he's gone, he's gone." And she ran into their bedroom and into their closet, and I followed her, and she opened the door, and there was his side, his rack of clothing and all his belongings were gone. And she was quite upset, and I took her car and drove to my father's work, and I sat down in front of him at 15, and I said, "Listen, seems as though somebody stole all your clothes out of the closet." And he said, yeah. He said, "I'm done. I can't do it anymore. I can't live it anymore. You're the man. You're the man now." And those words didn't quite sit well with me. I didn't feel like I was ready to hear those words. But that's what I got. Then my mom went into a very, very dark place, a very deep, dark depression, as you can imagine. She, one afternoon I woke up, I'd fallen asleep, and I woke up and walked out into the living room, and I saw my mother, very feebly, and like almost, it was like a slow motion crawl. If I could stand up, I could show you just what I saw. Do you mind?
No, you can stand up.
Thank you. I saw my mother, you know, in that mode. So instantly, I knew that something was dreadfully wrong, and there's drool coming out of her mouth. And as I was about to run and call, the front door busted open, and my uncle and two paramedics came in and threw on the gurney and whisked her out of the house to get her to the hospital to pump her stomach. And she had swallowed a multitude of pills to try to take herself out, to try to commit suicide. And when she got out of the hospital, she was a small firecracker of a woman. She was about 5'2". But when she got out of the hospital, the depression was so deep, she was down to, like, she lived on the couch, and she weighed about 70 pounds. And that, all that imagery spun into my head at that time, that I thought that was a very, in my head at the time, I thought that that was a cowardly way for my father to have left. And I was deeply upset by that. Until my father and I had a conversation years later, where I asked him what really happened, how did it happen when I was older. And he told me the story.
Your Honor, may we approach?
Sure.
Mr. Depp, how did you feel about your father when he left?
I was very disappointed in him, because I started to believe that his exit was sneaky, cowardly. He didn't, when he said goodbye to me when he left for work that morning, he just said goodbye. You know, goodbye, Bob. And I went, see you later, Pop. That was it. Until I learned the truth from him.
And without getting into what your father told you, how has your impression of your father changed now?
Objection, relevance.
Your Honor, this is just an understanding of his perception of his family.
I'll sustain the objection. Next question.
Mr. Depp, what have you learned from your experience in your childhood and observing your father in your childhood?
I learned that I was wrong about my first impressions of his exit from the family. Very wrong. And I'll tell you one thing that I learned that was one of the best lessons I believe I've ever learned in my life, ever could learn in your life, in my life, was based on my experiences as a child and what I'd seen and experienced. I knew exactly how to raise children when my girl Vanessa got pregnant. I knew exactly how to raise children, which was to do the opposite of what they did, of what Betty Sue did. Never raise your voice in front of the children, never. Screaming out the word no to them. I never wanted to tell my kids no. I wanted to tell them that. I wanted to show them that there were options. You don't have to stick the coat hanger in the electrical socket. You know, saying no is an abrupt thing, but to talk to them and say, if you understand the repercussions of something, then you won't go there. So maybe think about this as opposed to this. Give this some thought, you know? But that will clearly, that could kill you. So I would ease them away from things of that nature with a more of a conversation as opposed to a you know, a flat out, don't you ever do that again, and threats and things of that nature. I did not raise my children that way. Nor did Vanessa. We never raised our voices in front of our children, ever.
How do you think your experiences with your parents in your childhood affected your approach to your relationship with Ms. Hurd?
I'm sorry, one more time.
How did your experiences observing your parents as a child affect your approach to your relationship with Ms. Hurd?
Well, in the beginning of my relationship with Ms. Hurd, there was, from what I recall and what I remember, she was it was as if she was too good to be true. She was attentive, she was loving, she was smart, she was kind, she was funny, she was understanding, she and we had many things in common, certain blues music and, well, music, literature, things of that nature. So for that year or year and a half, it was It was amazing. There were a couple of things that, I don't know, stuck in my head that I noticed that I thought might be a little bit of a dilemma at some point. For example, I worked quite a lot, and when I would come home from work, I would come in the house or the hotel, and she would sit me down on the couch and give me a glass of wine and take my boots off, set them to the side, and I'd never experienced anything like that in my life. I just never thought that was, I just never experienced that before. And it became a regular thing that she did, this kind of routine. And I remember one night I came home from work, and I think she was on the phone or something, and or busy, she was doing something. And so I sat down on the couch and I took my boots off, and suddenly Miss Hurd approached with this look on her face and she just said, "What did you just do? What did you do?" I said, what do you mean? "You took your boots off." I said, "Yeah, yes, I did. You were busy, you know." No, "That's my job. That's what I do. You don't do that. I do that." "Okay, all right then." And then she said, "Let me get you a glass of wine." And she brought me the glass of wine. But I did take pause, of course, at the fact that she was visibly shaken or upset that I had broken her rules of routine. I thought that strange. And then once you notice something like that, then you start to notice other little tidbits and things that come out. And then within a year, year and a half, she had become this another person almost.
Mr. Depp, we're going to talk about Ms. Hurd in a couple minutes, but I'd like to first talk about your career in Hollywood. And so could you please tell the jury how you ended up acting in the first place?
I ended up acting by accident. I was a musician, and I'd moved out to Los Angeles with my band when I was 20 years old. And then there were a couple of things that happened in the band, where the band split up. And I remember I was filling out job applications, and then Nick, with a friend of mine who happens to be, he was an actor, less known than he is now, Nicolas Cage. And I was filling out job applications at any, you know, video stores, clothing stores, anything, you know, just to be able to pay the rent. And Nick Cage said, "You know, why don't you meet my agent, you know, because I think you're an actor. I think you could be an actor." And I said, "Look, I'll meet anybody, you know. I'll do anything at this point." And so he sent me to his agent, Eileen Feldman, and I met with her. She sent me to read for a casting director named Annette Benson, who was casting a film called The Nightmare on Elm Street. They brought me back to read for the director, Wes Craven, and I read for Wes, Craven, and somehow got the job. But I mean, I was by no means an actor. I didn't have any desire to be an actor. I was a musician. But the fact that these people were going to pay me what I found to be a ludicrous sum of money, which was it was kind of the SAG minimum. It was $1,284 a week, which I'd never seen that kind of dough before in my life. And so I suddenly, you know, and then I did some other couple of dumb movies because I still, in my mind, I was a musician, and this was just a way to pay the rent, pay the bills, live. Then suddenly I found myself on that road. I had been placed on that road as an actor, and then one thing led to another from film to film, and then I was cast in a TV series called 21 Jump Street when I was 22, I believe.
Mr. Depp, between the time that you were cast in Nightmare on Elm Street and you were cast in 21 Jump Street, mm-hmm. How did you enjoy acting during that time?
It was foreign to me. It was foreign to me, but I didn't have any great ambition to be an actor. I'm a naturally, normally, I've always been quite a shy person. I've always been quite introverted. And so there was a very strange metamorphosis from being one of four, that is to say, one of four in a band where you have this fraternity or this brotherhood, and you're out there fighting the world together to try to get that record deal or whatever you're looking for. And when I got on this series and my life started to change in various ways, that is to say that people started to, you know, you go into a restaurant and you'd see people whispering and pointing and all that. I was very uncomfortable with it. I was very uncomfortable with it, and I didn't like it. Just because it, and I never wanted to be the lead singer and the guy out front and we'll get all the attention. And I didn't. So suddenly I was on my own, and I was having to deal with this newfound sort of notoriety. And it was odd. It was very odd, and it was, yeah, it was a very uncomfortable thing. I don't think it's anything that one can get used to. I'm still not used to it now, which I'm actually glad that I'm not used to it, because if I were, I don't think I'd be the same person that I am.
Mr. Depp, did there come a time when you became passionate about acting?
Once I realized that's the road that I was on, and that any attempt at going back to music would be I hated the idea that since the television series had come out and I had been exposed as this character or this actor, I had to realize in my own mind and heart that there was no going back to music, because I didn't want to you know, I didn't want to use whatever amount of success that I had attained from the TV series and that sort of thing, I didn't want to use that to influence, you know, some career in music. I had far too much respect for music than to just become what they wanted me to become, which was a, you know, teen idol or a teeny, you know, that sort of thing. I fought that with everything in my being. So once I realized that music was no longer an option, then I began to study at various places, you know, the Loft Studio, which is now long gone, in Los Angeles. I studied with some other teachers, Sandra Seacat. I read all the books that you could read, and all that was great, but you realize that the only way to learn how to, it's not act necessarily, the only way to learn how to react and behave, because it's just behavior and it's reaction, was to do it. It's on the job training, it's trial by fire. So I did my best to work up my own approach towards a character and such.
And what were a couple of the first few projects that you worked on where you were really able to implement that approach?
I would say that the first film that I had done that I really took where I really felt, okay, I've done the work, I know what I need to do. I would say that was where I considered myself an actor, I suppose, was when Oliver Stone cast me in Platoon in 1986.
How did you come to be cast in Pirates of the Caribbean?
Well, that's many years later, but I had been, Disney had offered me a film called Hidalgo, when it was about a man and his horse in the desert and stuff, and I read the screenplay, and I just didn't think it was for me, but I wanted to have a meeting with them because I, at that point, I had a two and a half year old daughter, and for 3 years I watched nothing but animated films, cartoons from Tex Avery to Bugs Bunny to that was all I watched with my little girl. And I received the screenplay for Pirates, and it was I somehow in my mind I saw this opportunity, like a way to mesh characters like cartoon characters. For example, Wile E. Coyote gets a boulder dropped on his head, and he's completely crushed, but in the cut to the next scene, and he's just got a little bandage on his head. So I started thinking about the parameters that were available to cartoon characters. And if they were available to cartoon characters, and nobody ever asked a question, whether you were 5 or 95, you didn't ask a question. Oh, Wile E. Coyote, of course he's still alive. So I tried to incorporate these kind of ideas into the character of Captain Jack Sparrow, so that I could try to push those parameters and control the sort of suspension of disbelief, to be able to control the characters' actions, words, movements, and put them in a place where the things that he would do or say were so either ludicrous or mainly something that also something to the cartoon characters can get away with things we can't. Captain Jack Sparrow can do things that I could never do. He could say things that I could never say. So it was for me a way to stretch the parameters of a character and take a risk in doing that. But if it panned out, I felt I was on a pretty good mission. If it panned out, I thought that it might be a character who would be accepted by 5-year-olds and 45-year-olds and 65-year-olds and 85-year-olds, and in the same way that Bugs Bunny is,
You mentioned believed. You mentioned that you received the script. When was that?
I'm sorry?
When did you first receive the script for Pirates of the Caribbean?
The first screenplay I received was 2002, I believe. Yeah, 2002.
And what did you think of that script when you received it?
I thought that it had all the kind of hallmarks of a Disney film. That is to say, a kind of a predictable. Predictable three-act structure and the character of Captain Jack was more he was more like a swashbuckler type that would kind of swing in shirtless and be the hero, and I had quite different ideas about the character, so I incorporated my notes into character and brought that character to life, much to the chagrin of Disney initially.
Now, when you say you made changes to the character, how did you do that?
In preparation, the very same way that I've ever approached any character. You look for a back history, you base it on, it could be anything, like Edward Scissorhands, for example, I based on a dog that I'd had and newborn babies. My sister had a couple of new babies and I watched them, because I thought that Edward would see things from the sort of from a place of innocence, and not knowing exactly what things meant or were, and also that look of a pure innocent child when they experience something for the first time, those were the the two main ingredients that I thought would serve the character. And with Captain Jack, again, the cartoons, you know, the Pepe Le Pew, it's like making a soup, you know. It's ingredients. It's just ingredients. There's some Pepe Le Pew in there. There's some Keith Richards in there. There's a bit of a, you know, I figured this is a guy who's been on the sea for the majority of his life. Quite possibly his brains may have been scrambled a bit by the sun. And also I thought that he'd been on the sea for so long that he had his sea legs, but when he got on land, he just didn't have his land legs. So he could never quite stand still.
How did the film ultimately turn out in your view?
I didn't see it. But I believe that the film, well, I mean, the film did pretty well, apparently, and they wanted to keep going, making more, and I was fine to do that, there's great freedom in being able to, it's not like you become that person, but if you know that character, to the degree that I did, because he was not what the writers wrote, so they really weren't able to write for him. So once you know a character better than the writers, that's when you have to be true to the character and add your words, add the rewrites. I believed in the character wholeheartedly, and initially the Disney folks were somewhat upset.
Now, you mentioned that the film was, to your understanding, a great success. How did your life change after the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie came out?
Though I'd been around for many years already, and people knew who I was and all that. After Pirates 1 came out, there was a completely different way of life was being sort of, you know, my family and I were being plunged into. That is to say, you know, at our house in Los Angeles, you would have people trying to climb the gates to get into see Captain Jack Sparrow. You would have people trying to bust in the gates dressed as Captain Jack Sparrow. You would and follow you or follow you and your family. So that was the moment when there was no other way but to we had to hire more security guards, and I was certainly worried for my kids' safety. And so then instead of just the one guy, there became several security people, because I wanted to make sure that my kids were safe when they went to school or when they went to Disneyland or when they went to the mall or whatever. So yes, more security, and, you know, then just getting followed, you know, by hordes of paparazzi and things like that. I've had worse jobs, certainly. I can't complain about it. But, after a while you realize that anonymity has left the building. a long time ago. You know, the anonymity's gone. And that's an odd thing to deal with. When you just, I mean, you can't just drive down to the diner and get a cup of coffee or something. It's not possible. It turns into something else altogether. So it's, you know, it's acceptance. And there's, of course, there's a bit of sacrifice involved. I can't complain about the work that I've been given. I can't complain about any of that. I have no right to. But it does make you have to think very creatively with when you've got little kids about how to take them to the park or, you know, to the swings or to the this or that or movie or, you know, it becomes a strategic mission. And that's what happened after Pirates.
Now, you mentioned your family. Who did your family consist of at that time?
Vanessa, Paradis, the mother of my children, who we were together for 14, 15 years. Myself, our daughter, Lily Rose, and our boy, Jack.
Now, you mentioned hiring more security. Did you already have a security team at the time that Pirates of the Caribbean came out?
Yes, because there'd been more films prior to that. I mean, a number of films prior to that. So, I was recognized and I was known. So, if you wanted to attempt to have any experience that might be normal, you sort of had to have somebody around to get you out of a squirrely situation should it arise. So I had security prior to that for who would travel with myself and my family. But not like, you know, when I was at work, back then I didn't have security at work so much, you know, anything. Not before Pirates. Pirates was really that was the thing that everything, it all turned around. It all just went weird.
So how did your security team change after Pirates of the Caribbean came out?
Well, like I said, with anything, it had become more strategic, and you had to have more guys or gals, because if Vanessa, for example, she worked in France quite a lot, and if she was in France, and I was in LA with the kiddies, then and working. Security would basically pick my kids up at school or whatever and bring them home. So that became the routine, driving them to school, bringing them home. And then if I went somewhere, the security guards kind of multiplied because you needed to protect your street, your house, your kids. Endless.
So after Pirates of the Caribbean, who has been on your security team?
Jerry Judge was with me for, oh boy, over 20 years. Jerry Judge we've mentioned him before. It was a year or two ago. Jerry would go on film sets with me. He would do reconnaissance missions, you know, that is to say he would go to a country before we would go there, make sure all the hotel rooms were all taken care of and such. Or when I went on tour with, say, the Hollywood Vampires, which is a band that I played with, he would come on the road with me with another security guard. So there was Jerry Judge, there was Malcolm Connolly, who's been with me for 20 years or more, Leonard Damien, Sean Bett, Travis McGivern, Mark Gibbs. I mean, there are a few.
Are all of these security personnel still with you today?
Jerry has gone on to somewhere else. Jerry passed away from cancer. So Jerry made his exit. But the majority of I believe all of those fellows are still with me, yes.
When did Mr. Judge pass away?
I believe it was two years ago, roughly. Maybe a little less than 2 years ago.
Now I'd like to go through a couple of the names that you just mentioned. What is Malcolm Conley's purview in the realm of your security team?
What is his role?
Exactly, yes.
Now that Jerry is... Jerry and Malcolm had worked together for a very long time, so I'd met Malcolm through Jerry. After Jerry's passing, Malcolm obviously took over for Jerry, and so he took on extra responsibilities. He would have to make sure that there was someone on the ground wherever we were going that had done their recon, you know, the reconnaissance, and to make sure that everything was set up by the time we got there, and that it would be a straight shot into the hotel without a gaggle of paparazzi. You know, you didn't have to walk through 50 screaming, hollering photographers. So, you'd go in through a garage door and through a slippery kitchen, and you were taken to your room where you stayed.
When did Malcolm Conley join your team?
Malcolm had joined... I mean, Jerry brought him on, so Malcolm has been with me for over 20 years now.
And in those 20 years, how often have you physically been present with Malcolm?
With Malcolm?
Yes.
Endless, countless, all over the world. All over the world, everywhere. Los Angeles, Japan. Serbia, films, tour. Malcolm was my, when we were on the Vampires tour in Europe, throughout Europe, and Malcolm was on the bus with me. We lived on the bus together, basically.
How often is Malcolm in L.A. with you?
It depends. If there's a... Or if there was a larger premiere, you know, where it had to be worked out so that it didn't turn into a chaotic or dangerous event, because sometimes there are, between you and the people, there are these barriers, and sometimes the professional photographers or the professional autograph people will surge forward, and in the front rows of these, behind these barriers, you have little kids and older women and older men, and so when the professionals would surge forward, these people would start getting kind of crushed against this metal deterrent, and that was the most worrisome thing when you're at a premiere and there are thousands and thousands of people there, and I've always called it running the gauntlet. Essentially, what it is that people are there to say hi and to support the film or the cast or whatever. So I have always gone out and signed for those people. I've always gone out and signed for all or as many as I possibly could. I mean, to the point of sometimes Jerry Judge would literally pick me up off the ground to make me stop signing, take me away. It was those kind of things. Again, you don't really get used to that, you know. So I forget what the original part of your question was. I got lost in the gauntlet.
I'll move on. What about Sean Bett?
You want to go ahead and take a break now? Would that be okay for afternoon
That's
break?
Fine.
Why don't we go ahead and do that? Ladies and gentlemen, we'll go ahead and take our afternoon break. Please do, we'll take 15 minutes. Do not discuss the case and do not do any outside research, okay? Thank you. Stay there for a minute. All right. So just a reminder, since you're on the witness stand now, you cannot discuss your testimony with anybody to include your attorneys, okay? All right. And let's come back. I guess we can come back at 3:35. Is that okay for everybody? Okay. We'll take a recess. Thank you.
Thank you. All rise.